Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Maybe you've heard of the Clintonville Mystery House, or maybe you've driven past it. With its multiple decks, upper floor turrets, and mix of materials, the house at the corner of Indianola Avenue and Tibbet Road is hard to miss. It belongs to a guy named Bob Erickson, who's been renovating the home for 50 years. And if you think you know why he's doing it, you're probably wrong. Erickson's daughter, Ollie Malley, joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to All Sides. We're also joined by his grandson, Meshach Malley, who is making a documentary about the Clintonville Mystery House. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much.
Meshach, you describe the house as a Swiss Family Robinson home or Ron Weasley's house brought to life, which I felt after looking at it was a pretty apt description. Can you, for those who haven't seen it, can you kind of just give us a visual sense of the place?
Absolutely. So the house started as a three-bedroom kind of standard 1,200-square-foot Clintonville home, and over the last 50 years has expanded to what we're now estimating is around 5,000 square feet. All kind of cobbled together, a bunch of small rooms stacked on top of each other with no right angles anywhere.
The house is so unique that it's known around town as the Mystery House. And, you know, I think of the Winchester House, right? This famous house of this woman allegedly haunted by the victims of her husband, Winchester Rifles, guns. And she keeps building and building and building to keep the people away. That is not what happened in this case, right, Ollie?
Right. Not at all. So I've lived in this house. I lived in this house from the time I was 3 till I was 24. And the house was always changing and always evolving, starting at this, like Meshach said, a three-bedroom house. And one of the reasons was is that this is a story of the house that Meshach's telling in this documentary, but it's also a story of the people in the house. And my parents were foster parents, and had this mission to help children and families. And so in this house also has lived over 200 people. While maintaining the same owner. So people in and out of the house. So when I was growing up, it was filled with children that maybe were staying there for a weekend, maybe were staying there for years. But my parents really had a passion to deinstitutionalize kids and to put them in families and then to work with those families in very innovative and holistic ways to get kids back into a permanent home. And so lots was happening. So you can think about the exterior of the house and the uniqueness of it kind of being the same as what was happening on the interior and this really innovative kind of foster care and family care that was happening inside of it.
What was it like growing up in a house that's always growing and shifting and changing, not just with the people, but like the physical house itself?
Yes, it was very, I mean, that's just what was in my childhood. So one of the first rooms that was created was a pit, which was a sunken room that was, and it's still there, all filled with carpet. And we would hang.
Very 70s.
Very 70s, yes, very 70s. And we put pillows in there. We'd watch TV in there. My dad, he didn't just build on the house. He built like all sorts of things. He built me a balance beam or the balance beam for the kids there so that we could walk across the sunken room. There were swings and bars and rope ladders in the house.
This is a heck of a playroom.
It really was. And just the creativity that he put into everything. So this is happening. And then, you know, my dad just one day decides to dig out the basement. It was a small basement. You could barely stand if you were a full-size adult. He teams with a group of teenagers from North Broadway Church. They dig out the house, dig out the basement of the house. And then now in the basement, it's called the home base. There's a dining room, kitchen, living room, a small bathrooms about the size of an airport bathroom, and the laundry room are down there. But that was like the place where we all hung out. So the house was constantly changing. I was just telling Meshach, it was in my dreams, even as an adult, like of waking up in the house in my dream and going through it and finding like different rooms. And I mean, it stays with you because constantly changing. I mean, that's what it was. The people in the house and the house itself.
Yeah, Meshach, it reminds me a lot of fantasy in a way, that this house that grows and changes and adds new rooms, perhaps at its own whim. It's got that very whimsical, imaginative quality to it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the most creative places I've ever been in. And spending time in it, I find, is just such an invitation toward creativity when you see sort of the strange and beautiful architectural decisions that have been made in terms of just how everything is wrapped and contained together.
And, you know, obviously there is a certain segment that are going to go, wow, how'd he get the permits for that? And it turns out in about 2017, 2018, he ran into some permitting issues, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, there was a permit that lapsed. And then, you know, essentially the city came and did a full-on inspection. And what ended up happening was the house was sort of temporarily condemned until a large list of demands had to be met. And at that point, we as a family just sort of thought that this might kind of be the end of the house, and that kind of might be the end of its time. But my granddad is very persistent, and he worked hard, and he worked with a structural engineer, and they went through and they ticked off every single one of those, you know, requirements on the list to get that house back up to code and back up to a point where people could live in it safely.
So who's living in it now?
Okay, well, so after that happened, Meshach actually decided that he wanted to live in it.
Yeah, so this is fall of 2020. The permits finally get lifted. And there's this question of what do we do with the house? And kind of an email goes out to our family and sort of a number of ideas are presented. And at that point, I was still in undergrad and I said, I had an extended winter break. And I said, hey, what if me and my sister and my best friend, what if we move in and we just spend 2 months renovating the first three floors of the house and get some life back in it, get people, you know, kind of bring some energy back into this space that has been empty for so long.
Right. And so they did, brought life into it. When Meshach graduated, he got other people to come move into it. My dad actually owns that house and owns a house right next to it also, which is very interesting. The story is that he wanted to build a moat around him. So he's got three streets, an alley, and now the house right next to it.
Can you get a permit for a moat?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but Meshach brought in people to live in both houses. And that's what we continue to do. We're trying to maintain the houses by having people live there. We have a lovely cross-section of people who are renting rooms right now and bringing life into it. And that's how we're kind of keeping it going right now and keeping it in the family, which is something actually the family really wanted to happen. So there was a question like what we were going to do. And the family came together and said, we want to keep this house. And so that's what we're doing. And we're actually allowing, by doing that, Bob, who's been working on it for 50 years, is still working on it. So he's 82 years old. My mom is 82 years old. They're divorced now. My mom lives actually with us about a mile away. And both of them, he's continued to work on the house. My mom has continued to work for families and children. They're both passionately still doing what they've been doing, actually. And this is one of the things that Meshach will be talking about in this movie.
Yeah, when did you know, I want to make a documentary about this place? Like, what sparked the idea?
You know, I think I've known I wanted to make a documentary about it for a while. It was one of my favorite places growing up. It's the reason why I wanted to move back into it and bring life back into it. I shot my first feature film, I'll See You on Thanksgiving, in the walls of the house. I wrote the film for that house. And now this was a narrative project, so it wasn't a documentary. But I knew that one of the films that I wanted to make was about this house. And, you know, we're at a point where my grandparents are still very much with us, and I want to be able to tell their story firsthand. And so it just felt like the right time to capture that and tell that story to people that I know are interested in it.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's driven past it probably slows down. Like, how often do people, like, slow their car?
Right.
And it's like, what?
One of my favorite things when I lived there was people would walk by and they would be like talking and they would say things about the house, but they would almost always be incorrect. They'd be like telling a friend some story about it. And it was, I'm sitting on my front porch and I could hear them and I go, all of this is untrue, what you're saying right now.
So it has its own myth.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's so many myths and stories in Clintonville in particular of people that sort of see this and come up with their own narrative as to why this thing exists.
So what is the timeline for the documentary? Where are you in the process?
So right now we're getting started with interviews. And so one of the goals is, like my mom said, there were over 200 people that have lived in the house. Right now we're estimating around 156 kind of foster, adoptive, and kinship youth came through the house from 1972 to 2001. And so the goal right now is to kind of track down as many people as we can. We have some contact with many of them, and really kind of capture their firsthand experiences of what it was like to live in that house. So at this point, it is kind of gathering all of that and capturing interviews. And then we're hoping to have the film finished by next summer.
Oh, that'll be cool. You'll have to circle back with us when it's done and ready for viewing.
That would be amazing.
Have you ever thought, either of you, about giving tours?
This is something that you've suggested for a while, Mom.
I have suggested this for a while. I mean, people are so interested. I mean, people, like Mishik said, walk by all the time. And we have given some tours to people.
Do people ever knock and be like, can I see the inside?
People do, yes.
I had someone who came by and asked, he was like, my wife's birthday is coming up. Can she, like, come and get a tour? Like, this is what she would love.
So. Right. So we have thought about it, and maybe as a fundraising, I mean, the house still needs a lot of work, right? I mean, there's so much to finish on it, and so many projects that, and just to tell the story. So,
well, and I see
happen.
This documentary to some degree as being able to give people a tour of the house, right?
Yeah.
Like, obviously, you know, this is going to kind of pull back the layers, and you can see it from the outside right now if you walk by on the street. But I want to show you what the rooms look like. I want to show you how the architecture is put together, as a part of kind of this larger narrative of the why behind its creation.
I will say your 2-minute teaser has some images of the inside for anybody who is super curious. You can find it on Gentle Embers Media. I believe you also have it up on YouTube.
We do. Yes.
So if you really want a sneak peek of the inside, like I was like, and when you see it, that crazy staircase, I'm not sure where we are in the house, but right. There is this wild staircase. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's just as unique on the inside as it is on the outside.
Oh, absolutely. Perhaps even more so.
I think it's more unique. And the very interesting thing is we've named all the rooms, or
yes.
Most of the rooms have really interesting names. There's like the womb, which is the room of creation, which was like the art room. There's the pit I talked about. The solarium is this room with windows. The home base is the basement. The cupola is the very top, like the fifth or sixth floor.
Depending
we don't
on
even
how
know.
You count.
Depending on how you count. But yes, there's.
I love that there's a debate over how to count the levels.
Yes. Oh definitely.
Absolutely. Yes.
There's definitely all these half levels. Like, I had a bed when I was in my teenagehood that was like a hole in the wall. So it was, you went up steps in my bedroom to get to my bed.
Like some of those Japanese hotel rooms that you see?
Yeah, it was definitely, it was just like that. Yes. But I had a bedroom attached to it. That room somebody is living in now without the hole in the wall.
Right.
Yeah. That's so wild. I love that. I have a 5-level split. I don't know if you've ever seen those where it's like there's a partially sunk basement, a fully sunk basement. Then there's like main level. Halfway up is our master. And then another half up is like the other bedrooms.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's a pretty common home construction here. So I get the half level concept. But like people come in and they're like, oh, OK, I get it. There are 5 levels. It's kind of weird.
Yes.
Certainly nowhere near what that your house looks like, but it is interesting. And actually, the 3rd level, if I'm correct, Ollie, was created when you were pregnant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, the attic. So the attic was a regular Clintonville attic. When I was a kid, you couldn't even walk up into it. At 18, I got pregnant, and my dad had this crazy idea. He'd lifted the roof up on both
like
sides
do.
And created a absolutely stunningly beautiful apartment up there for me and my daughter, Jasmine. We lived there. Well, it got me through college, and I lived there until I graduated and started teaching in the Columbus City Schools. A bathroom, a kitchen, a living room, a bedroom, and that is still, actually, my dad has hopes for that area as maybe being an Airbnb or something that we can let people come into.
Oh, 100% people would pay for that.
It's not ready. My dad has expanded on it, which he has a tendency to do. It's got some needs to fix up, but he'd love to share that with people sometime in the future.
Yeah. And I just think, you know, having a baby at 18, it's a little young to have a kid.
Yeah.
I don't know the circuit, but like that your dad was like, okay, let's make this possible for you. Let's make it possible for you to go to college. It sounds like it was built like out of real love and a desire to help you not only have your daughter, but have the life that you still wanted.
Oh, it certainly does. They were so supportive. And the other part of that is my parents shifted then in terms of their foster care, and they started taking in teen moms with babies
after
that. And that was for a decade, that was part of their way of helping. They shifted to that, and we had so many moms and babies there in the house after that. So it wasn't just helping me, but then again, like what they've done their whole life is extended that out, and how can we help the community? And actually, one of those former teen moms who's now a grandma came back last month, spent a month staying in the attic, and I got to chat with her. I hadn't seen her since the 90s. Her daughter is now a mom herself, and it's just amazing how it came full circle through that.
I have a difficult question for both of you. Do you have a favorite room or a favorite part of the house?
Oh, that pit that you mentioned earlier has been one of the first things we did when we first moved back in was cleaned those 1970s mustard green carpets. Oh. And we installed a projector and a sound system on the wall.
Great place to screen the documentary.
Exactly. And so I've spent many nights in there watching films with friends and just enjoying people's company. It's a beautiful conversation pit and a great place to watch a movie. And so I think that has to be kind of my favorite room.
Boy, yeah, that's a hard question. Of course, I love the attic that we just talked about. My dad is very into light, so skylights and windows, and he's created even more. One of the unique new places is the solarium. So it's an all-windowed room. That has two stories to it, and the second floor has like a grate. The floor is a grate that you walk on and you can look down, but you sit in there and there's windows all around you. You see the outside, the old outside of the house there.
Exposed brick.
It is just lovely to be in there. But again, I can't name a favorite room. But
so final question for you, Meshach. How do we find information about your documentary, your production company? Like, where do we find more details about the Clintonville Mystery House online?
Absolutely. So Gentle Embers Media is my production company. And so we keep everything on gentleembersmedia.com. There's a link at the top in the menu bar for the Clintonville Mystery House documentary. We post information there kind of about the progress, about it, kind of information about what we're doing and keeping people updated. We're also on Facebook at Clintonville Mystery House and on Instagram at Clintonville Mystery House.
That was Meshach Mallie, documentary filmmaker and grandson of the creator of the Clintonville Mystery House. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to Ollie Mallie, the daughter of Bob Erickson and the former resident of the Clintonville Mystery House. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you have a story of a fascinating Ohioan that you'd like to share with us, you can email allsides at wosu.org. Coming up, the story of a doctor who started searching for a cure to AIDS in 1981. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're sharing the stories of fascinating Ohioans this hour. People whose dedication and drive, passion and perseverance can inspire all of us. In 1981, the world learned about a new disease. A virus we would come to regard as a four-letter word, AIDS. And while fear and grief ran rampant through the public, one Central Ohio doctor ran towards the problem, setting out to discover something that many thought to be impossible, a cure for the virus. His name is Dr. Michael Pera. He's an infectious disease specialist at The Ohio State University's Wexner Center. He's also the recipient of the Ohio Department of Health Director's AIDS Service Award, an AIDS Leadership Award, and the co-principal investigator of the ACTG Trials, one of the largest HIV clinical organizations in the world. Dr. Para, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me today. It's an honor.
I want to start at the beginning. So you graduate from Ohio State University's College of Medicine, and then you do a residency in Chicago, and you come back to Columbus, where you meet a patient with an extremely rare lung infection. Rare, except that similar cases are starting to pop up in cities like Los Angeles. Do you remember what it was like when you met that first patient presenting with this first set of symptoms?
It was a patient that was in the intensive care unit, and people didn't recognize what was happening. And we talked about looking for these unusual infections that you see in HIV, and that's what was discovered. This wasn't in 81, and I think we saw our first patient kind of in late 82. And we had already dealt with some of the fears at the medical center about handling these patients. So it was, and, you know, there wasn't much to do. Even then, the treatments for the unusual infections were not common and not very good. And I remember we actually had to get an experimental therapy to treat this individual's unusual infection. It temporized things, but he did not recover.
In the beginning, I mean, there was a lot of fear in the public about how it was transmitted. And then there was also a lot of fear because we didn't know how to treat it. We didn't know how to reverse it. And these infections are ultimately what become fatal in patients with AIDS.
That's correct. It, you know, it really generated, it did generate a lot of fear because we didn't know it was a virus to start with. We didn't know how it was spread. And this is where the CDC, their worldwide strength comes in. They would send, with those early cases, they would send an interviewer to go talk to the person. Where did you go? What did you eat? Where do you work? What do you do? You know, just where did you travel? What were your sexual associations? Did you have any blood? You know, and then even when we started in it, they wouldn't send an individual, but there was a 3 or 4 page form that I would have to fill out with every patient to explain any possible risk that they might have for any way of transmission. And so those were filled out. And what was critical was, you know, when people were hospitalized back in 81 and early 82, we didn't know how to handle that. The hospital didn't know how to handle them. Do you put them in airborne isolation? Do you, what
did
do
you wear
do?
Hazmat suits? Like what, how did you have to get suited up to go see them?
Yeah, we didn't, you know, we really didn't know. And in fact, those kind of things were very, hazmat suits were very unusual back then. People don't even remember, but you wouldn't remember, but people would go to the dentist and the dentist wasn't wearing gloves or a mask or anything.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that was standard. They just didn't have, we didn't have what's now called universal precautions, didn't exist. And it literally wasn't until like 1982 that the CDC said, this is the data we have. This is what we've collected. We know this is a blood-borne infection that's transmitted by sex. And so at least it told the hospital what to do with the blood, how to handle the blood. It told us how we dealt with the patients. I mean, I remember people were dropping the patients' food trays outside the room because they were afraid to walk in. So it was really important to get the information about transmission first, even though we didn't even know what the agent was. Back in 82, the CDC's data collection helped us feel assured that we weren't going to catch it by walking down the street. I mean, there were
nurses and doctors who refused to treat these patients.
Yeah, I mean, we had an infectious disease unit, and I can tell you that some of the nurses moved out, but we had nurses who moved in, who wanted to work on this infection. No, it really was true.
What made you want to stay?
That was the case. The people, well, so I had done my infectious disease fellowship and then spent 3 years in a virology laboratory. So I was familiar with the virus illnesses and viruses transmissions. In fact, one of my colleagues, AIDS was ever announced in the news and said they were seeing these cases and was asking me about viruses that I thought could do this. And there was none. So when I came here, I actually came, my idea was to come and work on uncompromised patients, transplants, and cancer patients that had these unusual infections. And it was like, oh, I get it. Now I'm dealing with HIV, which is exactly what I was trained to do in the last, 8 years. And so it was like, this was a disease that was made for a person with my training in virology and unusual infections. And so I was told that, here, you give the first lecture on it. And then I became the expert, even though I hadn't seen a case. But then I became, then all the cases started coming and I became more and more experienced. But as we all did in infectious diseases, this epidemic grew and grew. So I've been trained.
And that
was my destiny, I think.
Yeah, and it's become your life's work. You've devoted so much of your career to how do we treat patients with HIV and AIDS? How do we keep them alive longer, improve the qualities of their lives? How do we search for a cure? I mean, you're looking back on now more than 40 years worth of work in this field. I mean, it's impressive.
Yeah, it was, the cases came slowly, but grew and grew. And then it was important to establish relationships as we became, infectious disease became more familiar with this. It was important to establish a relationship with the public health department, the state health department, with the city health department, and my colleagues at other universities dealing with this. So it was important to develop a community of people who are interested in working on the topic. And then, just as importantly, it was important to develop relationships with the community so that they would trust us, that we would do the best we can, that we would be leaders in this and do the best we could for them. And so that was important. I remember sitting down one day with the people who formed the Columbus AIDS Task Force back in 83 or 84, where the task force at the time, which evolved to the AIDS Resource Center, then evolved to Equitas Health. But it was important for them to kind of work with us and get the gay community to understand we were the people that they could trust.
Yeah, I wonder, what was it like living in the community during all of this? You're working with patients who arguably the public is afraid of. You know, there's this really famous moment when Princess Diana shakes the hand of a person with AIDS, and people at that time were concerned that she could contract it from that handshake. Did people ever back away from you because you were the AIDS doctor?
Yeah, people would ask my wife, how can you let your husband do that? And her response was, if he doesn't know how not to catch it, nobody does.
That's a fair point.
So that was important. It was important not only to talk to the public health people, to actually get out to the medical community. And I did spend a lot of time going to hospitals in the area, giving rounds about how this disease, what we knew about the disease, how it was transmitted. And then eventually, as we started getting treatments, and I think probably maybe one of the most important things we did at the university is to get the AIDS clinical trial unit, as you talked about, because that's what Tony Fauci knew. When the first drug was first tested in the lab and then on a few people and looked like it may be helpful, Tony Fauci established this network. He knew that we needed to get these. He did this for COVID too.
It's Anthony Fauci you're talking about.
He really is. He knew that you need to get these treatments out quick. We need to test them quickly and get them out quickly. And so he established this network, and we applied for it and got it because we had, you know, we had the backing of the health departments. We had the backing of the community. We had, you know, the backing of the university to get one of these research units where we could start testing drugs. And I regard that as one of our major thrusts, was that when there was nothing and no hope, we could at least say, this looks like it might work, or at least partially work. And I think that gave people hope. And frankly, the community in Columbus got behind us, and we have always been one of the national leaders in how many people are interested in participating in these clinical trials to improve the drugs over time.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Anthony Fauci because you were actually suggested to us by a listener for this hour on Fascinating Ohioans. And she described you as the Anthony Fauci in Columbus during the AIDS epidemic. That was her way of referencing
you. Yeah, that's far-fetched. He had a much broader vision. He understood how to get things to work. I can deal with individuals. Tony is an amazing person. I mean, few people know it, but like when they started the COVID treatment trials, when they started to develop treatments for COVID, he established the network. He recognized the problem when there was like only one case in the United States. He recognized the problem, and he knew that he would have to assemble a team of researchers to start doing it. I mean, that's how visionary he is in dealing with these things.
Well, the listener, go ahead.
No, but you know, I think a huge credit has to be given to the community. We tried to communicate with the involved communities, and they were the ones who volunteered for the studies. So, I mean, they're the heroes. We're just the leader, maybe the conductors, but they were the leaders of the, because they volunteered and they helped us recognize what worked and what didn't work.
That's got to be a little bit scary, not only because I think entering into a clinical trial just probably feels a little unsettling to anybody, but because of the real stigma that they faced in even coming forward.
Right. No, that's fairly true. And honestly, because of this, I've actually been involved with HIPAA a lot, because HIPAA, when it came in 96, was long after the HIV epidemic. And I distinctly remember people being fearful that they got tested because if it got out, they would lose their job.
Oh, there was that
they
really
wouldn't get insurance.
Yeah, there was that famous movie. Was it Tom Hanks in Philadelphia?
Yeah. Yeah. So no, that was not fake. That was real. I distinctly remember that. And people were always, they were afraid to go to the doctor because it would get in their medical records. And then because there was no HIPAA, their employer would learn about it.
That's got to be so difficult. And so then these people who came to you at this time before HIPAA were really, they were taking pretty big risks. Now, obviously, AIDS was fatal. So I don't, you might have not, they might have felt like they had no other choice, but it's still like, we shouldn't underestimate how difficult those decisions were.
No, absolutely. It was, people were afraid to get tested because they didn't want it known.
You know, looking back, now AIDS is not considered fatal. If you take care of yourself, you take the medicine, you know, you follow a healthy lifestyle, you stick to the medications. We even have Truvada, which can help in the prevention of transmission. I mean, do you ever look back and think, oh my, wow, we've accomplished so much in 40 years?
Yeah, 40 years seems to be a long time, but it is true that, you know, we started with the drugs in 87, and then they worked a little bit, and then they worked a little bit more, and then they worked a little bit more. And then in 96, we finally had a regimen that actually seemed to stop the progression, although it was a regimen of relatively noxious medicines that was 20 pills a day or so often. And so even then people
that's hard to follow.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that was a major thrust of the time. How do you get people to take all these pills that make them sick to prevent them from getting sicker? And that was a challenge. But I mean, that's what the clinical treatment group did, is that we took the 20 pills and then they got them down to 16 pills, and then they were safer and more tolerable. And we just kept testing new and new generations of pills until we got literally to the one pill a day that completely stops it. And if that one pill doesn't work, there's five others just like it that work. And so we finally have something that completely stops the epidemic. And you pointed out that prevents you from acquiring it. But this, and it took a while to learn this, but it was a breakthrough, is that people who take the medicine can no longer transmit it. So that...
That's a huge change.
Yeah. I mean, not only that, it stops making them a pariah, a social pariah. If they told people who didn't know that they had HIV, they would be regarded as contagious or something you want to keep away from. But in fact, these pills, they are no longer an infectious risk if they take their medicines.
That was Dr. Michael Parra, an infectious disease specialist at the Ohio State University Wexner Center, who pioneered the drugs to help treat HIV and AIDS. Thank you so much, not only for your work, but for your time this morning.
Thank you. Take care.
Coming up, the man who has made it his mission to be Columbus's cat wrangler. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're sharing stories of fascinating Ohioans this hour. People whose dedication and drive, passion and perseverance can inspire or intrigue us all. So what happens when your cat decides to take up a new hobby, tree climbing? Who do you call? Do the police really come to get cats out of trees? Or should you call the cat wrangler? Dwayne Hook's TikTok account is aptly called Get Meow to Here, and he shares videos of himself climbing trees and rescuing felines from the traps they've gotten themselves into. And he joins us here in studio now. Welcome to All Sides, Dwayne.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So you share these videos of yourself rescuing cats and trees, essentially, on TikTok. Did you ever expect it to blow up the way that it has?
Not at all. I've been doing this since 2010. And
so long before TikTok.
Yeah, long before TikTok, and I am still in shock.
How did you first get into it? Like, what was the first cat?
My very first cat was on Beggar's Night in 2010. I'll never forget it. But as far as how I got into it, I'm a tree climber and a tree lover first. I'm very into trees, and I learned that cats get stuck in trees and that there was a national directory for people who climb trees that want to help out.
Oh, my goodness.
You can get on a website, catinatreerescue.com. There's a climber in the Pacific Northwest who manages this site, and you can say, hey, I want to be on the directory. So I got on the directory, and I'd forgotten about it. I hadn't received a call. And then I received a call, my very first call, and it happened to be Beggar's Night 2010. And I was working a job in a factory at the time, 12 hours a day. So after I got off work. I had my MapQuest map printed out.
And, oh, that's a throwback.
Yeah. And drove to this neighborhood in Columbus. I think it was North Columbus. And found the house. And this was my very first rescue. It was an amazing time.
Was it a nighttime rescue?
It wasn't a nighttime, but all of the kids were walking the streets with their costumes. And
you're up a tree.
And they were beggars. It was all trick-or-treating. And I pulled up in front of the house, and I'm looking to see if this is the correct house. And this little girl noticed that I was someone that didn't belong there, I guess. And she just screamed from her stoop, "He's here!" And all of these kids in costumes, they had known about this cat in the tree, had been up there for several days at this point. They just corralled me around to the backyard and pointed at the cat in the tree. And I didn't need a rope. A lot of these rescues require a lot of gear. But this was very simple. I just scrambled up the tree. It was a box elder tree. Very underappreciated tree, in my opinion. But I scrambled up the tree, and it was like a tortoise shell kind of Maine Coony long-haired cat. And I snatched this cat up. I didn't have my specialized bag at that time. I borrowed a pillowcase.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So I snatched this cat up and turn around, and all these kids are jumping and cheering like the little jack-o'-lantern plastic buckets, candy flying everywhere, and they're screaming. Looking up at this scene from above, at all of these children under this tree cheering, was just the greatest feeling, and I was hooked from that moment on.
So how often do you get called out to rescue cats?
Oh, it varies tremendously. Like, I may not get a call for a few weeks, and then I may get 4 calls in a day. You never know what these crazy cats are going to do.
So when did you first decide to start filming your rescues?
That's a good question. So being a tree climber first, and I would film these rescues. The first one I think I filmed was in 2012, and it was more to share. That's back when Facebook was still fun. And I would share with other climbers. I'm part of a large network of climbers, just friends. People who are into trees are kind of niche. It's a niche activity.
I would think so.
Yeah. And it was more about the techniques and the gear and, you know, how to approach these situations. And there are other friends of mine that would do this in other places in the country. But 2012, I think, was when I first got a GoPro.
And you kept doing it ever since.
Yeah, not religiously, though. It's like I don't film every rescue, but that was the first time.
Clearly, people are interested in your tree climbing cat rescuing work. You have almost 500,000 followers on TikTok.
It's unbelievable. I don't get it.
Do you, like, climbing companies reach out to you? Do you, like, kibble companies reach out to you?
Actually, no. It's crazy. Being a part of this social media thing has been very interesting to me. I do get a lot of companies reaching out to me to sell their goods, but I don't think I'll ever be doing any of that stuff.
So tell me a little bit about this specialized bag, because you've come a long way from the pillowcase. Because obviously you think cats are nervous. Cats have claws. They might freak out when you try to grab them. They don't know you. You're not their owner.
Sure. So negotiating with the cat is really the most difficult part of this endeavor. The cats they're frightened, and they're too frightened to come down. So now there's this weird guy climbing up the tree after them. And you never know how they're going to respond. Some cats are very happy to see me, and others, it takes a lot of negotiating. And sometimes they never turn to where they want me to help them. But my bag is essentially like a large laundry sack that I have sewn a 12 by 12 inch square of sports netting or golf netting into the bottom of, so that I can put my arm in the bag and reach my fingers through this netting and get a strong purchase on the cat, and then just wrap it up in the sack. Cat's in the bag.
Did you come up with that, or did you find it maybe from other cat rescuers?
Actually, I did not come up with this. There are a bunch of us across the country and the globe that do this. And I always try to push how many people that do this, that I'm no one special. I'm just some old dude that likes to climb trees, and I happen to like cats and will do what I can to help reduce suffering in the world. But there are a bunch of people that do this. And there was a guy in Georgia named Normer that he was the first person I saw use this particular type of bag. Granted, mine's a little bit different, but that whole netting idea, I don't know if it originated from him, but that's where I first saw it.
That makes sense. And I would imagine social media has also made it easier for y'all to communicate with each other and share best practices.
Yeah, we have a private Facebook group called Whiskers, Warm-Hearted International.
Oh my gosh, it's an acronym.
Kitty Rescuer Society or something weird like that. But and we will share different techniques. And we did have calls every now and then where we would just talk about what we have been seeing with these cats.
Do you have a most memorable or a favorite rescue? I mean, it would be hard to top the Halloween costume children.
Yeah, it is hard to top. I have several memorable rescues for different reasons. People have asked me often, what's the most difficult rescue? Well, some are emotionally difficult for me. Some are, you know, physically challenging. And then you have difficult cats. And so it's very difficult for me to answer that question.
Yeah. Because I wonder, the difficult cats, sometimes they may get up on limbs or far enough out on limbs that it's not safe, like, for you to get out that far. I mean, I guess if you're roped in, that's a different consideration.
Even with the safety precautions, cats are, they can go, they're much lighter than I am. So reaching them is a big part of the challenge. And that's one part that I love about this. As much as I love helping cats and helping people, they're humans, it tickles the problem-solving part of my brain. Like, how can I do this? How can I get to where this cat is? And I oftentimes have to come up with some pretty sneaky and neat solutions.
Do you ever use snacks?
Yes, I use snacks. I didn't use snacks in the beginning, or I would just have the owners give me some kibble or things like that, and it rarely ever worked. It's more of a peace offering than anything, because I don't want to just reach and grab a cat. I kind of give them this peace offering, and now I use these little tube treats.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. My old cat used to love those.
Yeah, and they're very effective. Cats really like them a lot.
They do work. It almost looks like a tube of mayonnaise, but it's not.
Yeah,
it's like a long, skinny, like, you rip it.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a meaty paste, I guess.
Yeah, I would not want to eat it, but they love it.
Yeah.
And especially, I would have to think, some of these cats have been up in these trees for days, so they're probably really hungry when you get up there.
Yes, and you'd be surprised how often they're not interested in the food at all. Even though they are very hungry, they are... Imagine being sleep deprived for 4 days in a tree that's always moving out on these little twigs. They do get crazy. They get into like a psychotic state, some of them, from being up there for so long without really sleeping.
Oh, that's really sad, actually.
Yeah, it is. I've seen some sad things with these cats in trees.
So it sounds like you should call somebody sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I have a rule that I don't stick to very hard, but I prefer waiting 48 hours. Most cats, about 70% of the calls that I get, I do a lot more counseling of humans than I do climbing after cats. And that has been an interesting part of this, because I encounter a lot of different types of humans. And I've learned different strategies for approaching cats. I've learned a lot of strategies for calming humans down and letting them know everything's going to be okay. But I try to wait 48 hours. So about 70% of the cats will climb down on their own. And that's always the best outcome, is if a cat climbs down on its own.
I got to ask, do you own cats at home?
At this time, I do not. But I have in the past. Every pet that I have kept in my life has chosen me. I've never went out and searched for an animal. And currently, I have a precious brindle pit bull named Chinquapin that I found in the woods, and she will not share me with another animal.
That reminds me, actually, there's another trend on TikTok called the cat distribution system. The idea being that your cat is going to just pop up one day and find you.
Yeah, I encounter a lot of cats, and people often bring this up. People also ask me why I do this, and I don't know, maybe you were going to ask me that.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's federally mandated now. I mean, since our country is effectively ran by cat ladies, so I have to do this.
It is a requirement.
Yes.
No. I love that. I think it's such a neat, side hustle or side hobby for you.
It is. It's a lot of fun. I never expected to have any of this attention that it's given me.
That was Dwayne Hook, cat rescuer and hero to family pets everywhere. You can find him on TikTok. And thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.